Good morning, Mendocino. This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the February 22nd edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month. Every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners, as I will be doing next Wednesday, February 29th. Well, amidst the daily reports of deadly bombings being carried out by the Syrian army against its rebellious citizenry, there's been an almost total absence of reporting about the armed insurrection that's being funded from a variety of outside sources, with apparently the deliberate intent of provoking the government's murderous retaliation, which today added the lives of two Western journalists to its death toll, as you've heard this morning on BBC and NPR. One of those outside forces is Al-Qaeda, which has long considered the secularism of the Syrian regime more of an anathema than its well-known human rights violations. And to make that point, Ayman al-Zawahiri, who replaced bin Laden at the head of Al-Qaeda, has declared it is the duty of all Muslims to take part in jihad in Syria. That members of Al-Qaeda have infiltrated Syrian opposition groups and likely executed recent deadly bombings in Damascus was conceded last Thursday by Director of National Intelligence James Clapper. The two bombings in Damascus in December, as well as deadly attacks on security and intelligence buildings in Aleppo the previous week, quote, had all the earmarks of an Al-Qaeda-like attack, Clapper said, adding that the network's affiliate in Iraq, quote, is extending its reach into Syria, end quote. As if to prove his contention, Iraqi officials announced over the weekend that the departure of Al-Qaeda-affiliated fighters from Iraq to join the rebellion against Syrian President Assad has had one benefit. Violence has dropped in Iraq in some areas by as much as 50% in just a few months. Iraqi officials declined to provide precise figures for the drop-off or to estimate how many Al-Qaeda-affiliated fighters have left the country for Syria. But the impact of the departure, they said, has been especially apparent in Nineveh province, which borders Syria and has long been the scene of some Al-Qaeda and Iraq's most violent bombings and assassinations. How what began as a legitimate nonviolent protest against the dictatorial Assad regime turned to an armed free-for-all, with the Syrian people now being attacked by an array of outside forces with competing agendas, as well as their government, is one of the things I'll be talking about at 20 minutes past the hour when I speak once again with Patrick Coburn, Middle East correspondent of The Independent of London and the brother of our northern neighbor and columnist for the Anderson Valley Advertiser and The Nation and co-host of Counterpunch, Alexander Coburn. Since Patrick Coburn has been following events in Athens and wrote a chilling piece on the collapse of the Greek economy from Monday's Counterpunch entitled Greece Throws in the Towel, Bows to the German Jackboot, another article yesterday on Greece's overspending on arms purchases, we'll also be speaking with him about that crisis. Meanwhile, some other news and views. Being on the same side of as Al-Qaeda apparently presents no problem to Republican Senators John McCain of Arizona and Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, who were on their way to the Middle East and spoke out Sunday in favor of arming the Syrian opposition forces. McCain and Graham laid out a series of diplomatic, military aid, and what they considered to be humanitarian proposals that would put the U.S. squarely behind the effort to topple Assad. The senators, both of whom were on the Senate Armed Services Committee, said that rebel fighters deserve to be armed and that helping them take on the Syrian government would aid Washington's effort to weaken Iran. They are already being armed, I assure you. Anyway, taking down both Iran and the Assad regime were among the goals of the Project for a New American Century, chaired by William Kristol, one of the premier neocons, Israel Firsters. Kristol, whose father Irving was one of the founders of the neocon movement, now heads one of PNAC's twin successors, Foreign Policy Initiative, as well as the Emergency Committee for Israel, a super PAC, which has become infamous for its attack ads on President Obama and American politicians seen to be soft on Israel. Not critical of Israel, mind you, but seen not to be as loyal to Israel as Kristol himself. On the Foreign Policy Initiative's board of directors, we find fellow neocons Robert Kagan, whose wife, strangely enough, Victoria Nuland, is Secretary of State Clinton's press spokesperson, and Dan Senor, who, as you may recall, was the public mouthpiece of the U.S. occupation forces in Iraq. The other successor to PNAC is the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, which came into existence 2 days after 9/11, and whose agenda reveals that it, too, is primarily concerned with what it perceives to be Israel's interests. On its nine-person leadership council, one finds, voila, the same Bill Kristol, Senator Joe Lieberman, and Max Kampelman, one of the founders of JINSA, the Jewish Institute for National Security, whose motto is, quote, securing America, strengthening Israel, unquote, which Colin Powell would later blame for having gotten us into the Iraq War, and which is pushing just as heavily at this moment for an attack on Iran. Among its 12-member advisory board are a couple of familiar names, Richard Perle, one of those credited for orchestrating the Iraq War, and House Majority Leader Eric Cantor. Thus, it should come as no surprise when last week 57 so-called foreign policy experts and former U.S. government officials signed an open letter to President Obama, organized by the Foreign Policy Initiative and the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, urging the president to act more assertively to stop the Assad regime's war against Syrian civilians. The letter calls on the president to, quote, immediately establish safe zones and no-go zones within Syrian territory, end quote, without mentioning that doing so would be an act of war. And then, quoting again, establish contacts with the Free Syrian Army and provide a full range of direct assistance, including self-defense aid, improve U.S. coordination with political opposition groups and provide them with secure communication technologies, and work with Congress to improve crippling U.S. and multilateral sanctions on the Syrian government, end quote. That they would effectively be taking sides with al-Qaeda seems to bother them no more than it does Senator McCain or Graham or did President Reagan in 1981 in Afghanistan. Both of these organizations are run by Washington political heavyweights who have a long history of putting what they consider to be Israel's interest first and foremost, and they work closely with AIPAC and four other pro-Israel think tanks in formulating U.S. Middle East policy. Those other four are the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, which was created by AIPAC in 1985, the American Enterprise Institute, the Hudson Institute, and the Saban Forum of the Brookings Institution, founded and funded by Israeli-American Haim Saban, one of the Democratic Party's main money sources, who proudly claims he is a one-issue man, and that issue is Israel. One cannot begin to understand U.S. Middle East policy without taking these organizations into account for one very simple reason, and that is that you will not see or hear a single individual on any of the news networks or on NPR AM radio discussing U.S. Middle East policy that does not belong to at least one of these pro-Israel think tanks, but which, mind you, are never identified as such. In other words, these are the people who shape the opinions of the American public on the critical issues of war and peace. As a symbol of their success, they can point to a recent Pew poll reported in today's New York Times that indicates, even after long and destructive wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, that 58% of the American public, would support an attack on Iran to take out what they have been convinced by these talking heads is that country's nuclear weapons program, despite the fact that even the White House says there is no hard proof that a weapons program even exists or that they've started one. That might help explain why last week 32 senators from both parties, there's really only one party when it comes to Israel, introduced a Senate resolution that would declare that not only containing a nuclear Iran is not an option, but even an Iran that has not yet built a weapon but is suspected of being capable of doing so. The resolution, which was introduced Thursday, quote, strongly supports U.S. policy to prevent the Iranian government from acquiring a nuclear weapons capability and rejects any policy that would rely on efforts to contain a nuclear weapons-capable Iran. Not a nuclear-armed Iran, but a nuclear weapons-capable Iran. And, quote, urges the president to reaffirm the unacceptability of an Iran with nuclear weapons capability and oppose any policy that would rely on containment as an option in response to the Iranian nuclear threat, end quote. In other words, they're calling for war in Iran. A group of the senators held a press conference Thursday on Capitol Hill to explain the thinking behind the resolution and reinforce its bipartisan character, including, as could be expected, Senators Joe Lieberman and Lindsey Graham. Quote, there are so many things that we can disagree on, said Graham, but we found something we can be united about and hope the American people will take comfort in the fact that Republicans and Democratic senators are joining forces to stand behind President Obama on one very important issue, end quote. Yes, go on. We agree with you, and we have your back, Mr. President. President Obama is absolutely right that it's absolutely unacceptable for the Iranian theocracy to obtain nuclear capability, end quote. Lieberman, one of the sleaziest individuals ever to sit in the Senate, and that's saying something, emphasized that he doesn't want to foreclose diplomatic options, but said that if Obama decided to attack Iran's nuclear facilities, he would have strong bipartisan support in Congress. That's something Joe Lieberman has publicly been calling for since 2007. The resolution, it can be assumed, was drafted by AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, which is the only organization registered to lobby for Israel, but not obliged, like the lobby for every other country, to register as a foreign agent. Writing on the Just Foreign Policy blog, Robert Naiman suggests that, quote, "For all it has done to promote confrontation between the United States and Iran, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee has worked to avoid the public perception that AIPAC is openly promoting war. In AIPAC's public documents," he notes, "the emphasis has always been on tougher sanctions. If you make sanctions tough enough, an effective embargo, that is an act of war, but it's still one remove from saying the U.S. should start bombing." He goes on, "But a new Senate effort to move the goalpost of U.S. policy to declare it unacceptable for Iran to develop a nuclear weapons capability, not a nuclear weapon, but the technical capacity to create one, gives AIPAC the opportunity to make a choice which all can observe. If the Lieberman resolution becomes an ask for AIPAC lobbyists at the March AIPAC policy conference," writes Robert Naiman, "then the world will know AIPAC is lobbying Congress for war with Iran," end quote. Sponsors of the Lieberman resolution deny that it is, a quote, "an authorization for military force," and in a legal technical sense, notes Naiman, they're absolutely correct. It is not a legal authorization for military force, but it is an attempt to enact a political authorization for military force. It is an attempt to pressure the administration politically to move forward the tripwire for war to place indistinguishable from a, to a place indistinguishable from the status quo that exists today. If successful, Naiman notes, this political move would make it impossible for the administration to pursue meaningful diplomatic engagement with Iran, shutting down the most plausible alternative to war, end quote. Already this year, Congress has passed a resolution prohibiting any U.S. official from President Obama on down from negotiating with any Iranian official without providing a justification for the meeting to the House and Senate Foreign Relations Committee 15 days in advance. In other words, what can truthfully be called our Israeli-occupied Congress is making U.S. Middle East policy, not the president, who is authorized to do so by our Constitution. During AIPAC's annual policy conference, the first week of March, President Obama will meet with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, hoping not to see a repeat of last year's meeting between the two prior to the same conference. At that time, during a joint press conference, the Israeli Prime Minister publicly dressed down Obama like a schoolboy, and then 3 days later went on to speak before a joint session of Congress where he received 29 standing ovations, beginning with the moment he entered the House chambers. The announcement of this year's White House meeting came in a briefing of a weekend visit between Netanyahu and Obama's National Security Advisor Tom Donilon in Jerusalem, amid Washington's stated concerns that Israel might attack Iran to thwart its nuclear program without informing the U.S. in advance. Mr. Donilon and his delegation addressed the full range of security issues of mutual concern, the White House statement said. The visit is part of the continuous and intensive dialogue between the United States and Israel and reflects our unshakable commitment to Israel's security, end quote. I assure you that there will be no commitment, shakable or unshakable, to Israel's security on March 3rd in Washington, D.C., the day before the AIPAC conference begins, when I will be participating in a panel presentation on the Israel lobby, together with three former guests of mine, Professor Hatem Bazian, Grant Smith of Institute for Research Middle East Policy, and Allison Weir of the Council for the National Interest, at the Occupy AIPAC conference in Washington, being planned by Code Pink, U.S. Committee to End the Occupation, and the Institute for Policy Studies. As if the Obama administration not already have problems on its Middle East plate, Egypt state media has announced that on Sunday the government will put on trial 43 people, including at least 16 Americans, charged with unlawfully conducting what they claim to be pro-democracy work. In what the Washington Post describes as the latest sign that the Egyptian government is disinclined to heed Washington's warning that failure to drop the matter could lead to a cutoff of $1.5 billion of U.S. military aid. While there are members of Congress who have long been eager to halt funding to Egypt, should the U.S. take that step, it would likely be seen as violating the terms of the Camp David Agreement, negotiated between Israel and Egypt in 1979, in which the Carter administration committed the U.S. to funding both parties as long as they observed the terms of the treaty and maintained peace between the two countries. Consequently, since President Obama does not want to take any action that might be used by Egypt as an excuse to abrogate the treaty, it appears that he and his administration will have to swallow the humiliation of seeing Americans put on trial by an important but shaky ally, something the Republicans are sure to exploit in the run-up to November. To rub it in, polls taken in Egypt indicate that since the $1.5 billion is all in military aid, most Egyptians couldn't care less about it. The announcement of a trial date came as a state-run newspaper, Al Aram, published several stories that portrayed the work of the non-government organizations as serving, quote, specific political tendencies and countries' agendas, despite the fact that they did not have a license to operate, end quote. As I reported on my last program, two of the organizations targeted in the probe include the Washington-based National Democratic Institute and the International Republican Institute, both of which are components of the congressional-funded National Endowment for Democracy, or the NED. Since it was founded in 1983, the NED has compiled a long and sordid reputation as serving as a front for the CIA in its efforts to overthrow governments that do not sufficiently genuflect to the interest of the United States, and there's no reason to believe it is doing anything different now. The seven Americans will go on trial, work for Republican Democratic Institutes, which are informally linked to the respective political parties. Senator John McCain, who chairs the Republican Institute, was reportedly going to stop by Cairo on his Middle East trip in an attempt to get them off the hook. According to Al Aram, General Martin Dempsey, the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, had already tried that on a visit to Cairo, but Egyptian officials turned down his request. Finally, a brief update on the proposed Walmart expansion. On February 8th, the Planning Commission heard supporters and opponents of the expansion express their opinions as to whether the commission should approve a statement of overriding considerations that would state that having Walmart open a 24-hour supermarket in Ukiah trumps the threat to public safety that would ensue with the greatly increased traffic at the 101 Talmadge Airport Boulevard interchange should the project be approved and for which there is no proposed mitigation. At the commission meeting, one of the Walmart employees acknowledged that she and all the Walmart employees who have testified in favor of the proposed expansion before the commission have been paid by Walmart to do so.